a person inside a prison without food, without medicine, then he hasn't any choice but to knock the door, but to try to escape towards the life. This is exactly what the Palestinians made in Gaza. They said to Israel, our well of life is stronger than despair. So we continue, we want to struggle, and we struggle for life, we struggle for humanity, we struggle for justice.
And so people are protesting. They're engaging in this weekly mass protest, and you've been met by massive response of the Israeli military.
Yeah.
Talk about what happens in these Friday protests around the fence.
Yeah. Yeah, some people asked me, and some journalists asked me, why the Palestinians continue their protesting despite the high price of victims and injured people. I answered them, the Palestinians are continuing their protesting because this is their only choice. They haven't other choices. They try to escape towards the life. So the people, when the people shared in the March of Return, in these protests, they came to the near the fence that separated them from their villages and cities, and the people collect peacefully.
That was the Gazan poet, journalist, and peace activist Ahmed Abu Artima, speaking on Democracy Now! In 2019. An Israeli airstrike has killed 5 members of his family. He was seriously injured. Coming up, we'll speak to an Israeli man who helped negotiate a prisoner swap with Hamas in 2011 that freed the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit after 5 years in exchange for the freedom of more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. Back in a minute. عليها ناس معلقين بخيط وقعوا عن سطوح العمر وسلقتن الحجار وقعوا مثل ما بيوقع المشمش علي Those Who Had a Home by Sabreen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Israeli military has announced it now believes 229 hostages are being held by Hamas and other militant groups in Gaza. The hostages were seized on October 7th when Hamas carried out a shocking attack that Israel says killed about 1,400 people. Hamas has released 4 hostages so far. On Thursday, Hamas officials claimed the Israeli bombardment of Gaza has already killed 50 of the hostages, but the group did not provide any evidence to back up this claim. A Hamas official who's part of a delegation visiting Moscow says the group will not release any more hostages until Israel halts the airstrikes. Meanwhile, families of the hostages continue to call for their loved ones to be safely returned. This is Hadass Calderon in Tel Aviv.
5 members of my family been kidnapped. 5. My mom, my niece, 2 children, Erez Sar, and their father, Ofer. A week ago, I was announced, I got the information that my mom and my niece been murdered. I didn't have time to grieve and to go to the funeral. Today, a week after, I went up to the grave. So today I was crying and grieving. And now I'm celebrating, you know, this. It's a surrealistic situation. We are celebrating my son, Erez, is 12 years old today. We're celebrating his birthday. He loves the mountain bike, and his father also is very professional in riding bike. So that's what you see, and I wish he could be here to enjoy with everybody and to feel like a normal boy.
We're joined now in Jerusalem by Gershon Baskin. He is Middle East Director of the International Communities Organization Human Rights Advocacy Group. In 2011, he helped negotiate the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit from Hamas captivity after 5 years in exchange for the release of 1,027 Palestinian prisoners. His memoir is called In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Gershon Baskin. If you can say what you think needs to happen right now.
What needs to happen is what Hamas spoke about already 2 weeks ago, which is a release of what they call the civilian hostages in exchange for an immediate ceasefire. That's what Hamas has been saying since yesterday. And yesterday, there was a change of tone from Musa Abu Marzouk, is the Hamas official who went to Moscow. I communicated with Dr. Musa Abu Marzouk yesterday, who for the first time said there needs to be a ceasefire first, and then we'll talk about the hostages. Right now, Hamas is holding women, children, elderly people, wounded and sick people, who is obviously against international humanitarian law to hold them, to abduct them, to kill them. It's also against Islam. It's against their own beliefs in the Quran to take women and children and elderly people as hostages. I think that Israel is prepared to grant a ceasefire to stop the bombardment of Gaza and to enable civilian hostages to come home. We have to be clear also who we're talking about, because for Hamas, every Israeli is a soldier. So it needs to be defined who they are talking about when they're talking about civilians. But there's a big complication here, because Hamas is probably not holding all the hostages. The Hamas political leadership, which is scattered between Gaza, Beirut, and Doha, is not in charge of the hostages, and it's not clear that when they make an obligation, say to the Qatari government, that they are willing to negotiate some kind of deal, that they are actually able to implement the deal. There's a big question about it, of who is talking to the people who have control of the hostages, and whether or not Hamas at all has control of all the hostages, because some were taken by Islamic Jihad, some by PFLP, and some by individuals who are holding hostages.
Talk about your back channels, Gershon, to Hamas, to Egypt, and to Qatar.
I've been talking to everyone. I've been talking to Hamas people in Gaza, in Qatar, and in Beirut. It's a very difficult conversation. And my assessment today, 3 weeks into this war, is that they don't have a coherent strategy. They're not all giving the same messages. And as I said, I'm not sure that they even have control. The Qataris were talking quite a lot, wanted direct contact with the Israelis. Myself and a colleague who's in Rome put them in direct contact with the Israelis. It's not sure who they're talking to on the Israeli side, and if the people they're talking to the Israeli side are actually sitting in the war cabinet making the decisions. It seems that the side with the best contact are the Egyptians. The Egyptians were responsible for releasing the second two women who are Israelis without second passports. They're Israeli Israelis, members of a kibbutz along the Gaza border. One of them has been a peace activist and a volunteer driver of sick Palestinian children from Gaza to Israeli hospitals for years. And it seems that they were released as a result of Egyptian pressure on Al-Qassam, on the military wing of Hamas.
That was Yocheved Lipschitz, who also spoke to the press after she was released. Her husband is still in, also well known as a peace activist who went to the border crossing repeatedly to help Palestinians, and especially those who were having medical problems.
That's right.
So how did the first two hostages get released? And do you see anything large happening now?
So I think my understanding of what happened with the two sets of women who were released is that the first one was the result of direct pressure of President Biden and Secretary Blinken on the Qatari government, who applied pressure on the political leadership of Hamas, who is hosted in Qatar. And they and President Biden mentioned their names, specifically their American citizens who live in Chicago. I believe that the second set of the two women who were released was a result of the Egyptians wanting to show that they could do better than Qatar in releasing two elderly women who are full Israeli citizens without another passport. The Israelis weren't involved in either releases at all. They had no part of it. And Israel didn't pay anything for those releases. I really think this is some kind of negotiating game and the competition that exists between Qatar and Egypt. I think that the Israelis are holding off on the ground incursion of thousands of Israeli troops, tanks and artillery and special forces in order to exhaust every possibility to bring out as many hostages through negotiations. This seems to me the reason why the Israeli delay on the incursions. In the meantime, Israel is going in with small forces. For two nights now, they've done this to, I think, assess the situation on the ground, to take care of specific intelligence information they have about Hamas battle plans once the incursion begins, and probably with special forces to see if they can find any of the hostages.
And how important is U.S. pressure on them to delay the invasion or to stop it altogether? And do you see the U.S. putting that kind of pressure? Originally, President Biden said he was not telling Netanyahu to use any kind of restraint.
Right. So Israelis and others, Americans, have said that the Americans are encouraging Israel to wait and to exhaust every possibility for negotiations, to wait with the ground operation. I think it has been influential, but there are more and more voices in Israel who are calling to the Israeli government to recognize their moral responsibility to the hostages, because the number one function and responsibility of any state is to protect its citizens. And Israel clearly failed to protect these civilians who live along the Gaza border and enabled them to be murdered and to be taken hostage. So there are calls, significant calls from Israelis, not like me on the left, but from the center of Israel's society, from the national security establishment, who are saying that Israel first has a responsibility to bring home the hostages. There are even several of them, including a former head of the Mossad, who said that Israel should even empty out all of its prisons and send all the Palestinian prisoners to Gaza in exchange for all the hostages being released. I can't see that happening. But I think that there is more time, although not a lot, for a negotiated agreement for a release of the civilian hostages. I think it's important to note that the American government is and should be placing pressure on Qatar. Qatar has been the host of the Hamas leadership for many years. It has funded Hamas with more than $1 billion over the years. And Qatar, if it doesn't comply with American demands to put pressure on Hamas, Qatar should threaten the Hamas leadership that if they don't comply, if they don't pressure their own people back in Gaza, that they will be exiled from their welcome stay in Qatar. And Qatar, by hosting Hamas, is in a way a state that's supporting terrorism.
Gershon Baskin, I wanted to ask you about a number of the hostage families and families of those Israelis who Hamas killed on October 7th, like Chaim Katzman, who was a University of Washington graduate student, came back to the kibbutz. He was trying to protect others. He was in a closet, and he was killed. We spoke both to his Seattle rabbi, where he was a Hebrew school teacher in Seattle, and his brother Noy, who is in Vienna in Austria. Both called for an end to the occupation and said the invasion is not the answer to what has happened. Your final thoughts on what needs to happen now?
Yeah, I hope that after the Israeli people are experiencing the biggest trauma since the Holocaust and the Palestinians have been taken back to 1948 in the Nakba, that we wake up from this traumatic situation and understand first the Israelis, that to delude ourselves that we can occupy another people for 56 years and have peace is simply not real, or that we can lock 2 million people in an open-air prison for 17 years and expect to have quiet is living in an imaginary world of delusion. I hope that the Palestinian people wake up and understand that they will never have peace if they don't recognize the Jewish people's right to live in the land of Israel as well as their right to live in the land of Palestine. And that when this ends, I call it the day after tomorrow, because tomorrow is too soon. But the day after tomorrow, I've been calling for what the metaphor I use is the Belfast moment, the moment when we stand up and say we've been killing each other for 100 years and we have to stop. Our leaders need to pay the price for bringing us here, Israeli leaders and Palestinian leaders. They all need to go. And we need a new generation of Israelis and Palestinians who are willing to stand up with new ideas, new visions, new hopes, new dreams, and the ability to lead us forward on the very basic principle that everyone living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea must have the same right to the same rights. That is the basic principle from which we have to start. And from there, we can decide if we want one state, two states, three states, or 10 states, a federation or a confederation. But it begins with the mutual recognition that we all must have the same right to the same rights.
Gershon Baskin is Middle East director of the International Communities Organization, a human rights advocacy group. In 2011, he helped negotiate the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit from Hamas captivity in exchange for more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners. His memoir is titled In Pursuit of Peace in Israel and Palestine. Next up, we speak to New York University law school student Rena Workman, who lost her job at a prestigious law firm, lost their job at a prestigious law firm after speaking up for Palestinian rights. Back in 20 seconds.
بكاء بلا صوت من ماسحة الدموع قدم عيونها تفتح مداها سياج الممنوع قلتها ممنوع لي ممنوع لها مسموح لي ممنوع لها والمسموح لها فيش كلمة هيك بقاموسها طائفنا عاجرين اللي تدوس حقوقها يوم ورا يوم تعيد نفس اليوم الأولى بالأم والأخيرة بالنوم هذا مني إلك يا امرأة يا أم البيت مني أنا
Freedom for my sisters by the world's first Palestinian hip-hop group Dom. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how students, professors, and others advocating for Palestinian rights across the United States are facing racist attacks and other threats to their free speech, safety, and livelihoods. This week, Florida ordered state universities to ban the group Students for Justice in Palestine, accusing it of supporting a terrorist organization. The group Palestine Legal is documenting and supporting people who were fired or faced other retaliation for sharing social media posts or signing statements in support of human rights for Palestine. This includes our next guest, Rena Workman, who was removed from their position as president of the NYU Law School Student Bar Association, and saw their job offer at the corporate law firm Winston & Strawn withdrawn after they sent a newsletter to classmates expressing, quote, unwavering and absolute solidarity with Palestinians and their resistance against oppression toward liberation and self-determination, unquote, after Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel and the subsequent number of Palestinians who died in these last weeks. On Thursday, the Senate unanimously passed a resolution, quote, condemning Hamas and anti-Semitic student activities on college campuses, unquote, which referenced Rena, though not by name. This comes as doxing trucks target people at Ivy League universities who sign Palestinian solidarity statements, now appeared at Harvard, at Columbia, University of Pennsylvania, with digital billboard screens displaying people's faces, their names, and above them saying, anti-Semites. Palestine Legal and over 600 other legal groups and leaders issued a letter calling on elected officials and institutional leaders to address the, quote, hundreds of incidents happening across the country that signal a much broader effort to criminalize dissent, justify censorship, and incite anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, and anti-Muslim harassment, unquote. The letter notes this is not a new phenomenon, but it's escalating at terrifying speed, unquote. For more, we're joined in Chicago by Dima Khalidi, the founder and director of Palestine Legal. and by Rena Workman, the NYU law student who had their prestigious job offer rescinded. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Rena, why don't we start with you? What exactly happened?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I think that, you know, I sent a message to my fellow law students supporting Palestine and offering context to a narrative that I already saw building that was excluding, you know, the 75 years of history that we've seen in Palestine, the apartheid, the military occupation. And I wanted to, you know, add that I support Palestinians in their movement for liberation. And that is what my message was intended to get across.
And what happened?
You know, after that, we saw this incredibly swift backlash. I lost my job offer. You know, my school immediately put out statements that distanced themselves from me, offered me no specific protections publicly. And, you know, I've been receiving hateful and racist and transphobic and queerphobic messages for the past 3 weeks that have only gotten more vile and more hateful as time has gone on.
And what about your position both at NYU and your offer of a prestigious law firm employment?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the consequences that I'm personally facing are, you know, devastating for me. But I'm also really concerned that it's just promoting this chilling effect that we're seeing across not only my law school, but across universities and other law schools across the country, because folks are now afraid to speak up in fear that they might, you know, become the next me, that they might lose their offer simply for supporting Palestine in fighting this oppression and trying to end this genocide.
So what do you say to the law firm now? And have they reconsidered?
The law firm has not reached out to me at all. And right now, I really just want to focus on, you know, calling for a ceasefire and ending this genocide. And I really just want to say to everyone who cares about human life and cares about, you know, stopping this killing to call for a ceasefire and, you know, and end this genocide that's happening right now to the Palestinians.
I want to bring Dima Halady into this conversation. How common is what happened to Rena Workman?
It's become very common. Palestine Legal has been documenting for years what we call a Palestine exception to free speech. So it certainly didn't start on October 7th. We've seen these same kinds of tactics, severe doxing, attempts to get people fired and investigated, to punish boycotts for Palestinian rights and other advocacy through legislation and an attempt to purge academia of voices that support Palestinian rights. But since October 7th, when we've seen people mobilizing for Palestinian rights, we've seen an exponential increase. We've had more than 300 requests for legal help, more than we get in a whole year, typically. And Rena is really not alone. And we're seeing dozens of people getting fired and facing employment consequences around the country for making simple statements in support of Palestinian rights. We're seeing students get disciplined. As you mentioned, Amy, there is a widespread attack on the student movement for Palestinian rights, which has built an incredible cross-movement, has built cross-movement alliances on campuses for the last decade. And really, people's livelihoods are being threatened, and people's lives are also under attack. We saw a six-year-old Palestinian boy murdered just for being Palestinian. So this is a widespread effort to intimidate, as Rena said, intimidate people into silence. But Rena is also not alone in the sense that there are so many voices who are speaking out because people are seeing more and more clearly what is happening here. This is about 75 plus years of a settler colonial state that has dispossessed an entire people of their land and of their dignity and of their humanity. And what is happening now is a complete dehumanization of Palestinians that is coming from the mouths of Israeli officials, which, by the way, have been speaking in genocidal terms about Palestinians for 75 plus years. And it's being echoed by our own elected officials repeating to level Gaza and to wipe Palestinians off of the map. This is a genocide that is unfolding with U.S. support, and more people are seeing that. And that's what's critical here. We have to speak up. We have to protect people who are under attack for speaking out, because that is our responsibility as U.S. citizens whose taxpayer money is being used to fuel this incredible attack on Palestinians.
Can you talk about what's happening in Florida? Governor DeSantis demanding of the state university system to disband the organization, the Palestinian Student Organization, Students for Justice in Palestine.
Of course, DeSantis is often the front runner when we're talking about undermining our constitutional rights. And once again, he has attacked a student group based on their fundamental First Amendment rights to engage in advocacy on this issue. His move is fundamentally contrary to the First Amendment, and it will be challenged. There is no doubt. This is also an attempt to criminalize what students and others are speaking out about. And there is no basis for this. And frankly, it's part of DeSantis' broader agenda and the right wing's broader agenda to undermine fundamental First Amendment rights by criminalizing protests for racial justice, by criminalizing protests for environmental rights and indigenous rights, and by purging academia of people and curricula that are trying to teach about the sordid history of racism in this country. So it is part of his effort to whitewash our universities and academia from dissenting voices. And this has to be challenged in order for us to maintain the fundamental constitutional rights upon which this country is based and that are essential for any prospect of maintaining democracy in this country.
I mean, it's been interesting what's happened. You've got the doxing of students, for example, at Harvard and at Columbia. At Harvard, the more traditional conservative organization, Harvard Hillel, actually also condemned the doxing of students and these billboards that are going around with protesters' faces with the word anti-Semite above it. And at Columbia, is it true that the pro-Israel and the Palestine groups together condemned the doxing?
The doxing is one of the most heinous ways of attacking people. These are students, these are individuals who are, you know, working in various arenas, and they are being severely harassed. Their information is being publicized. They are being barraged, as Rena has, with death threats and horrible misogynistic, transphobic, and racist messages, and their livelihoods are being threatened. So we have seen even pro-Israel groups condemn this because they see how horrible it is for their own peers to be faced with this kind of harassment. And universities are really failing to protect their students here. We've seen a couple of instances where universities are beginning to take measures to prevent this doxing.
And finally, Rena Workman, your final comment. Also, who ousted you as president of NYU's Law School Bar Association?
So the SBA, the Student Bar Association, originally initiated proceedings against me, but since have all resigned. But currently, due to messaging from Dean McKenzie, I am suspended until further notice from all of my presidential duties. And so even though I cannot, you know, say anything or do anything as SBA president, I still want to say as a person that we should all be calling for a ceasefire and an end to this genocide.
Rena Workman, I want to thank you for being with us. NYU law student who had a job offer rescinded after speaking out in support of Palestinian rights and calling for a ceasefire. And Dima Khalidi, founder of Palestine Legal. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
Do you like music or do you like technology? Or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.